again, before I really, really talk about what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use some terms. I'm going to be very, very loose about them. So I'm going to sort of combine HCI and CS and say they're kind of the same thing, because from a user standpoint, and I am in the HCI area, the interface is the application. And another thing I'm going to do is I'm also going to call CS as basically an engineering enterprise, even though it's got science in the name. And yeah, I know we do a lot of different things in computer science, but you'll understand why as we get through this talk, why I'm really thinking about the engineering aspects of it. And as one of our faculty members quite famously said in a faculty meeting, we're all software engineers. And so with that, I think we can sort of put on the fact that we're, you know, in some regards, we all have to be software engineers, that we're going to look at the world in a slightly different way. But you have to start from some place, and the place we're going to start from is the idea that we are engineers. So, talk, that's the big part, creative computing, or the art of innovation. What could that possibly mean, creative computing? We have around this campus an initiative called Creative Technologies, which seems to be the application of computing in art and music, and a little bit in communications, and maybe a little bit in theater. For those of you who saw Tom Igoe's talk last fall, you think like, I can't really locate where that guy's supposed to be. So this is what we're talking about. We're talking about ways in which the intersection of art and engineering can produce innovation. But in fact, I really want to also talk about art, science, design, and engineering as four things together. It's not just art and engineering. So first we have to ask a pretty simple question. Where does innovation come from? I mean, what is innovation? And I open up to the graduate students first. Where do you think innovation comes from? Where do those things come from that are sitting in front of you that allow you to read email or check on Skype or do a Google search right now about whatever random thing that comes to your mind? Where does that come from? What drives that? Anybody? How did it come to be? Pardon? Needs. Oh, where do needs come from? Consuming. So there was a need for Google, and no one knew about it until it happened. Right? Is that, huh? Problems. Where do problems come from? Nobody knows where problems come from? You just wait for them to show up? Are you sitting in your cubicles for a problem to fall on you? Matt, where do problems come from? They come from a solution to other problems. That's one way to think about it. That's definitely true. That is definitely true. Problems are narrow, solutions tend to be wide, and when you try to fix those things on the side, then that's one good model, yeah? Make our lives easier. Middle class values test. You want to have an easy life. Trinity? Random meetings in the hallway. Okay. So what happens in those random meetings in the hallway? No one's used the word idea yet. I'm surprised no one said ideas. Where do ideas come from? That's sort of what you're saying. Yeah. All right. In the hallway. They come in the hallway. All right. Yeah. All right. So we haven't really systematically talked about the idea of innovation. And there are places you can go, in fact, even on this campus, where they study innovation as a process, as a thing, you know, between an idea, a need, a problem, and getting it out on the street and seeing if people will buy it, getting it into use to see if it actually fits with what people do. But that process is not necessarily an engineering process. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. So we're going to talk a little bit today about how the four creative disciplines, as identified by my friend and colleague Rich Gold, discussed in his book, The Plenitude. By the way, everything that's underlined on here are hot links, and these slides will get posted, so you can go click on these things and figure out what it is that I was actually talking about. You don't have to take those kinds of notes about references here. But let's look at this diagram of art, science, design, and engineering. And you'll see that, in fact, that's kind of interesting, because if you look along the right side, what science and engineering have in common is that they're, you know, built on a kind of mathematical foundation. They believe in a kind of mathematically based set of principles. If you look across the top, for example, though, you also see there's an affinity, because art and science both, and these are cartoons, I might add, are interested in finding out a truth, right? So they're much more philosophically based, whereas that design and engineering are much more relativistic in their set of values and set of goals that they're trying to accomplish. You might be, well, can't be relativistic with engineering, you know, you don't want bridges to fall down. But in fact, where did the values go come from that says you've done a good job in engineering and design? They come from the real world. They don't come from a notion of truth, they come from a notion of utility. And utility functions tend to be pretty much human-centered. That's kind of interesting. Human-centered. But isn't art and design, you know, sort of the same thing? We teach it in the same program here at Virginia Tech. Well, no. Again, this is a cartoon. The artist paints a picture. He said, this is it. This is truth. This is the way I see the world. And designer says, do you like this? If not, I can change it. This way you'll buy more of them, right? So you'll see that there are ways in which these things all interact with each other. What's particularly interesting to me, and will come up again and again, I think, in today's talk, is the last one on the top there, aesthetics. So does anyone know what that's a picture of there in the upper, on your upper left corner? Yes, it's a rabbit. I'll give you that. But no, it's not. It's turned out to be this is not a computer science rabbit. For our Brazilian students, this is the work of a Brazilian artist, Eduardo Kak. He hired a genetic engineering firm to create a rabbit that had its genes for glow in the dark added to it from a jellyfish. Interesting gasp up there in the audience, as though this is a horrifying, interesting, scary thought. Well, Eduardo Kak did this because he was interested in getting us to see differently, and to think about the fact that we can now turn life forms into works of art. You know, that's a kind of weird, scary thought. But actually, in reality, the bunny doesn't look like that. Turns out it doesn't glow in the dark, but he just, even though the gene was put in there. But it's a family pet in reality. But it was the idea. So he's interested in a kind of beauty that's very different than the kind of beauty that, for example, Don Knuth talks about in The Art of Computer Programming. So if we were to say that, let's say the code for PGP, and you'd say, there's a kind of elegance to that, right? That's a kind of value that we have, a kind of beauty that we see. Do you think that the kind of beauty that Eduardo Kak is thinking about and the kind of beauty that Don Knuth are thinking about are the same thing? No. You think they'd have an interesting conversation with each other about that? Yes. I think that could be a very interesting conversation. And in those interesting conversations, that's one of the places we get ideas. It's one of the ways we drive innovation. And that's what I'm talking about today. That's really the essence of what this talk is about, and about that particular way of seeing the world as that tension between those two worldviews. And of course, I'm not going to dismiss the science and design ones. I come from the design world in my background, so I can't really say that I'm going to dismiss that. And of course, I've also done some science when I was at Xerox PARC. So the real interesting question is, how do you collaborate across these axes? And so there are various ways to do that. And what forms of collaborations are there? What sorts of results do they deliver? And what sorts of new knowledge are created? Interestingly enough, we are interested in knowledge in this, not just in innovation itself. Innovation and knowledge have a very funny relationship, which I'm not going to spend time today talking about, but it is an interesting set of questions about that, whether or not Apple Computer is creating new knowledge or not with making products that are well-designed that people want to buy. Some of the forms we're going to talk about in this are artists supporting engineers or engineers supporting artists. We can talk about that. We're talking about inspiration, where in fact there's not actually an actual collaboration of the two working together, but the idea in one inspires another. We're going to look at where the two worlds meet. They discuss ideas, but they don't actually build each other's work. They don't really work that tightly on it. And then eventually, you'll see that you blur the boundaries. You begin to see that the artists and the engineers begin to do very similar things, and it's hard to tell which one's which. I'm going to talk about other people's work and my own work, but first off, I'm going to start with an old piece of work. This guy is Billy Kluver. He was a research engineer in the 1950s and 60s at a place called Bell Labs. Faculty, don't answer this question, please. What was Bell Labs? Somebody tell me what Bell Labs was among the grad students. Somebody must know. Heard of it. Come on, Bell Labs. No, it was Bell Labs at first. It was Bell Labs from about the 1918. Started in lower Manhattan, moved to midtown Manhattan, then eventually to Murray Hill, New Jersey. Anybody know what Bell Labs is? This is good, you're gonna get a little history lesson here. Has anyone ever heard of Unix? Who has heard of Unix? Raise your hand. Why is there Unix? Huh? That's where, why? What? That's part of the why, but that's down in the bits. Let's go. Why did Bell Labs? Okay, let me move on. Okay, little digression. I have digressions in this talk, which will help, a little bit of, get you facts out here in addition to the argument I'm trying to make. You can read the slide, but Bell Labs was developed by the phone company when it was a monopoly in order to keep its monopoly position. It was required, basically, in its own self-construction to continue to be at the forefront of research. In fact, we have nothing like it today. It was a huge operation. Most of the great innovations of the mid-20th century came from Bell Labs, a monopoly. So we talk about the marketplace as driving innovation. It's true, marketplace does drive some innovation. But in fact, monopolies also drive innovation because they need to keep their position. And the answer about why there's a Unix, it's because as a monopoly that was a phone company, they were enjoined from building computers. And yet they had invented the transistor. They had invented information theory. They invented the bit, but they couldn't build computers because they were prevented from that. So they turned what was a problem for them into an advantage for us, building the first really good multi-hardware platform operating system. And of course, developing C along the way. Some people, that side of them probably loves it, that side of them probably hates it, or some combination thereof. And along the way, they did a few other things besides get six Nobel Prizes, but they invented sound motion pictures, transistors, photovoltaics. They verified the Big Bang. They invented the laser and charge coupled devices, which are in most digital cameras. That's a lot of cool stuff, right? A lot of real innovation. That's pretty remarkable, huh? Yeah, I worked for Xerox, so we don't care about those. Yeah, fax, bad. Fax was bad. So Billy Kluver was a research engineer there, but he also liked art. And it was really convenient that Murray Hill was just across the river from Manhattan. And so he fell in with some of the great mid-20th century American artists that were living in Manhattan or visiting. The French artist Jean Tinguely, who was a sculptor, was his first collaboration, where he worked on a thing called Homage to New York, a project of a sculpture that, over the course of about an hour, caught fire and burned itself up and then tore itself apart. He worked with the sculptor Clyde Soldenberg, and then with the painter Jasper Johns. Jasper Johns wanted to have a painting that had a piece of neon coming out of it, but Jasper Johns didn't want this to look like a floor lamp, so he didn't want a wire coming out the bottom. So Billy Kluver was the first person to be able to power a neon light with a battery. Seems like a pretty unremarkable thing now, but since Billy was sort of a nice guy, he figured out how to do this. Billy then realized that, in fact, there were a lot of engineers at Bell Labs who might be able to help some of the artists with some of their ideas and began to do more and more collaborations. He worked with Merce Cunningham, the choreographer, Namjoon Paik, the video artist, Stan Vanderbeek, who was a filmmaker, and a performance piece that required that the people be mic'd so that the heartbeat of the dancer could be broadcast into the audience as help as part of the score, or part of the musical score for the piece. And he did that because he needed a microphone, so he invented the first FM wireless microphone, just like the one we've got on here today, right? So that was the event that sort of drove that particular piece of innovation. Working with artist Andy Warhol, he developed the first Mylar balloon. I know that not everything here that Kluver worked on was of real earth-shattering importance, but all those Happy Valentine's Day balloons actually can be traced back to the Andy Warhol, Billy Kluver collaboration. So there's actual innovation going on. This became a pretty interesting operation. Eventually, he had 1,200 engineers signed up to assist artists in something called EAT, the Experiments in Art and Technology. And there was a particular event called 9 Evenings of Theater and Engineering. It's a great title. And I'm going to, I have a short video clip to show you of documenting one of the pieces in the 9 Evenings. It's called Open Score, done by the artist Robert Rauschenberg, who was Billy Kluver's primary collaborator. And they do use the term collaborator, so we talk about collaborations. This is one of the first places we see that term used actively. Rauschenberg had lined up the artist Frank Stella, an abstract expressionist painter. Frank Stella lined up his tennis pro. It turns out that abstract expressionist painters live a very middle-class life, and that the two of them played a game of tennis in an augmented reality tennis match. Well, they didn't call it augmented reality. We would today call it that, using effectively instrumented tennis rackets. And I'll just play a few seconds of this. It's not very exciting video. And hopefully I can get this up. So you'll notice that the tennis rackets make a sound, and that one of the things happening is that the lights are going out. So each time the ball is hit, the sound triggers one of the lights in the hall to go out as though the sun were going down. So it's an abstraction of an actual unlit tennis court game. There are other parts to this, and if you think about the word score, you know, it shows up in all three of these movements. They call the movements the tennis game, so you make score. There was a after the hall gets dark, that people are invited onto the floor and they're given instructions about what to do. They were, and based upon some signals that were given to them, they couldn't see each other. It was so dark, but they had the first night vision video camera. In fact, the U.S. military had enjoined anybody in the U.S. from selling this, but they were able to import one from Japan. And then they used one of the first video projectors ever to project this image on the screen so people could see only indirectly what was going on. So people were performing things so they, with other people, at least they were trying to, but they couldn't see each other. It was one of these sort of funny kind of events where you could see things that were being done according to a score, like a musical score, like a choreographic score, even though the actual performers couldn't see each other to perform with them. So it's a kind of bad cartoon of HCI research in some ways. You know, a lot of lessons in here, incidental lessons. There was also a musical performance involved. In any event, all this was done with a small army of volunteer engineers from Bell Labs. And on the on the disc. If I had more time, I would show you some of the interesting reflective testimonials on the part of the engineers about how this really drove their thinking. So we also look at an example of art inspiring technology. This is some of my own work that, I mean, on the research side. In 1980, there was a project by the video artists Sherry Rabinowitz and Kit Galloway called Hole in Space. And that it was a real-time open link from Century City to Lincoln Center. Here's a picture of the Lincoln Center end of this thing. It was the week of Thanksgiving, so there were people out Christmas shopping. It was in the evening, and people were walking down the street, and all of a sudden in this window, there would be these other people. And they would be, in New York, they were dressed, obviously, because it was, in a way, it was very cold, and the people in Los Angeles were dressed very lightly because it was pretty warm, and so they clearly weren't just around the corner somewhere. And what's really amazing is that people just stop and talk to each other in a way that they wouldn't otherwise do. The work of art was, in fact, not the technology per se, but the reconceptualization of what the sidewalk is. And a notion of how people behave on the sidewalk. So it changes people's behavior. So it's a very interesting way of thinking about both the work of art as a work of art, what means to be a work of art, and secondly, to think about how technology really can change the environment, which is in fact something we do every day when we're in HCI and CSCW research. So, very interesting piece, not well known, although it was on the nightly news at the time it went on. I came to Xerox PARC in the mid-1980s and worked on a project called the Media Space with my colleague Bob Stultz, and that we heard about this, and how I heard about it and how we interacted with Sherry and Kit on this project is documented in a chapter in HCI Remixed, which is linked to here. And it's a long and interesting story, but it's an interesting digression again. In any event, though, our interest was in how groups could work together who were not physically co-located. And I've got to remind you that this is a very interesting time. But before that, I have to talk a little bit about Xerox PARC, another research institution that people may have heard of. It's an industrial research lab. Its focus was on offices and documents, not on sidewalks or on art. It was a very button-down operation. But it had two kinds of research traditions, one of which is an academic one, which looks a lot like what you guys are doing. So you would resonate with what was going on there. And for those of you that have been interns there, you mostly see a sort of academic model. There's another part of PARC, not necessarily another part of the building, but people in the next office who are much more like Thomas Edison. They're tinkerers with technology. They try stuff. And a couple of PARC catchphrases that are build what you use and use what you build. And the other was the best way to predict the future is to invent it. That's an Alan Kay line. They were taken very seriously at the time I was there, less so now. But they did result in some pretty interesting stuff. Laser printing, personal computing, but not the mouse. Pay attention to that because that'll come back later. Object-oriented languages, more or less. The local versions of Ethernet, not the Ethernet between campuses. And prototypes became Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop. We'll talk more about that specifically in a minute. So here's a picture of Randy Smith talking to me over the Media Space. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is that the time we did the Media Space, networking was not thought of as something that would carry audio and video. That was, in fact, research in that was not considered legitimate. What did that have to do with office work? We had telephones, right? Video, why would anybody want to pass an image around at all? That seemed like a pretty crazy idea. But the fact of the matter is, it turns out that Ithia de Sola Poole at MIT in about 1980-ish had said, if we go to fiber optic communication, bandwidth will be basically free. He didn't even see that we could do it with copper, but he said, with fiber, so what it'll be like? And one of the things he said is that it means you can just leave cameras and monitors on. You can just have connections going all the time. And what happens to physical space when you do it? And so that's what the Media Space project was about. So there was a case where the Hole in Space project really got us to see what we were reconceptualizing, the way in which space was thought of and the way people would behave in space as part of this thing we thought it was just a way of having, you know, coworkers talk to each other or coworkers be aware of others' presence. It really had a much more profound effect. Really interesting dialogue there between the art and the technology research. Let's now talk about a case where we actually have real sort of one-on-one collaboration. And I'm going to talk about, again, some more examples from Xerox PARC. The first one is Bitmap Graphics Editors. This is sort of an not so unexpected one. Also talk about Ubicomp, and along the way, the PARC Artist Residence Program, and see a little bit of video of a big project called Experiments in the Future of Reading. So where do paint programs come from? Where do bitmap graphic editors come from? They come from a collaboration between a guy named Bob Flagel. Has anyone here ever heard of Bob Flagel? You're a scientist? Not likely you have. He didn't publish. And a graphic designer named Bill Bowman. Bob Flagel told lots of stories, still does. Not all of them are very believable, but he has told this one over and over again, so I half believe it. But he said that when he went for his job interview at PARC, he had just graduated with a BA in math from University of Utah, and I guess George Paik, who was putting PARC together, thought that he was one of the graphics crowd from University of Utah, which was very famous. Was very famous there at that time. They were working computer graphics, and Flagel was a very good, very quick study in computer science, and he'd taken a couple of computer classes, thought it might be interesting. But he was more interested in the trip to California to go to the beach than he was in actually working for Xerox PARC, because it was only two employees at the time, and you know, he didn't want to work for a big company. So what he said to George Paik was something that he thought would be sure to get him kicked out. He said he wanted to draw pornographic pictures with a computer. And George Paik thought this was an interesting challenge. He said, how would you do that? And on the spot, Bob Flagel, who didn't know very much about computer graphics, described bitmap graphics to him. He said, that's very interesting. How would you like to stay and work on that? Wise guy. So you can't read it from here, but the date on this documentation is 1976. This is the documentation for Toolbox. And Toolbox was the work that Bob Flagel did. In order for Bob Flagel to do this, of course, since he had no training in art, they said, we will go out and hire a graphic designer to teach you how to draw. And furthermore, that from him, you'll also maybe be able to figure out how to build the technology so that you can do that drawing on the computer. And Bob did eventually learn how to draw on both the right side of the brain and the left side of the brain. So here's an example from the Toolbox documentation of the kinds of very big blocky bits that you could draw with. But you know, it was a pretty reliable tool. In fact, even when I got to PARC in the mid-80s, they were still using the umpteenth generation of this thing in some parts of PARC. Bob even learned how to draw a little bit, and again, using the Toolbox bitmap graphics editor. And all of this was really due to his close work with Bill Bowman about what it was that you'd want to do when you could draw. So the actual implementation of the bitmap display turned out to be pretty straightforward, and eventually led to things like BitBlit, variations of that are still used in displays today. And that, of course, the interesting story is that while Xerox thought it was building a business around that other PARC alums went off and made a much bigger business of that, because they saw that what was really interesting was not the interface to it, the drawing program, but in fact how you would share all kinds of graphics. So that's another story. Another artist, much later on, at PARC, was Natalie Jeremy Jenko. Natalie, by the way, we hope to have come visit here in the end of March, tentatively agreed to visit, as part of the cyber art project. But Natalie was trained as a scientist, a various kinds, and that came to Park as part of the Artists in Residence program, which again Rich Gold and I put together. It was modeled after the EAT program at Bell Labs. But the goal here was not to, unlike the EAT program where artists were gonna, or engineers were gonna help artists do artwork, the idea here was that they would come up with better questions, that artists would go away with better questions and better ideas, and that the researchers would go away with more interesting questions and more interesting research. And we had about 20 plus artists that we paired up with researchers over a course of about 8 years. It's documented in that book over there, but Art and Innovation. In any event, Natalie came, and she worked with Mark Weiser. And I'm, okay. Among the grad students, who has not heard of Mark Weiser? That's a name everyone should know, Mark Weiser. Good, good. No one's gonna admit they don't know something. But Natalie and Mark hit it off. Mark had just written the article that went into Scientific American that describes ubiquitous computing. And Natalie said, so there's this network in the ceiling. How do I know what's going on? He said, well, you can look at your computer, you could look at this. No, what's going on? You know, it's like there's this buzz in the air. And he said, what do you mean there's a buzz in the air? And she came up with this idea that they would put a basically just a simple port on the Ethernet cable and attach that drive a motor. And that on the end of that motor, hanging out of the ceiling, was a red string. And the more of the traffic, the more of the packets, the faster the string spun. And the string would spin smoothly for, say, a large FTP, or sporadically for bursts of email or chat traffic going back and forth. And it's really the first example of an ambient display. So in HCI, those of you not in HCI, there is a category of display where you put something in the background in the environment that you want to alert people to sometimes, or if they want to have just sort of in their consciousness. It's like the sound of rain on the roof. That's a kind of naturally occurring ambient display. It provides an awareness, but this was particularly interesting because it would provide an awareness of something that's not particularly important unless you're sort of a network specialist, but it's important in some other kind of abstract way, which is the network traffic. You know, that there's this electronic buzz going on that you have a sense of on your own workstation, but you may not have a sense of the sort of global effect, or in this case, the area-wide effect between what was effectively a router and that device. She also worked with me on another project proposal, which was another kind of display where that we would sort cars coming into a parking lot for the Olympics in Atlanta. This was not accepted by the Olympic Committee, unfortunately. And then we'd draw patterns of the cars, you know, based on their color. You know, we'd assign a parking place, and then you'd be up in a tall building, you'd be able to look down and see what the pattern was of the cars that were parked at the, you know, you had all sorts of interesting ideas. Alas, not to be. But the more you do stuff like that, the harder it is to tell who's the artist and who's the technologist, who's the engineer. Because it turns out that a lot of the people who come in to do this actually have day jobs that are pretty technical. It's rather remarkable. So with that, I need to give you one little bit of background, and that is that there are methods in art that can be that turn out to be interesting research tools in CSCW and in HCI. And in particular, we're interested in ones what we call critical theory. John Canny at UC Berkeley in the computer science department is very big on critical theory, and so you often see this sort of buried down in papers by him without any real reference to what he's talking about, because he sort of assumes, being a place like that there are people around who just know what it is. But I find that coming here, I have to explain it a little bit. So one of the things that we might look at is genre, that is to say, the kind of thing that the media, or the, in a case, computing, we think of computing as a medium. might afford, one of the different forms. And you might also look at systems of meaning, other kinds of things that are particularly interesting. So with that kind of set of eyeglasses, term that they like to use at Park a lot, that we did a project called Experiments in the Future of Reading. Now this is a very odd thing because, as you can see here, it's actually a science and technology exhibit. And it was really intended initially as a showcase of Park technology, a PR device. But not, you know, because we were all kind of clever people and decided we need to get papers out of this, that we weren't going to stop at just building something that just showed off, here is how laser printing works. Nope, we were more interested in using this as a place to take another step with the technology. And the technology in particular here,
the digital explosion, by which we mean reading. From ABC News, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
Learning to read is a foundation for life, but the actual act of reading may be about to change quite dramatically. A laboratory called Xerox PARC in Palo Alto, California, where the computer mouse and the laptop were developed, has been looking at the possibilities. And here's ABC's Jack Smith.
We are all used to reading like this. But this?
We call this the tilty table.
Or this? Completely new ways of reading words.
We believe that the digital explosion actually creates more reading than before. It also creates many more kinds of reading.
It's been 550 years since the printing press was invented. Reading is an old technology, but far from making it irrelevant in the future, the new digital revolution is expected to make reading even more important.
This is called Speeder Reader. It's a way of reading very quickly.
Instead of my eyes scanning across, I'm reading one word at a time.
Right, and your eyes are staying steady, allowing your brain to process very directly.
Is this perhaps a way we might read in the future?
Yes.
Or maybe this way.
I can tilt it this way and I'll move over this way. It's like surfing through a large document. While this table is only 3 feet by 3 feet, the document I'm looking at is actually about 30 feet by 30 feet.
And in this other display, containing enough information to fill a 50-page book, by moving a trackball.
And what it does is it takes the center and moves it to the edge and moves what you're moving towards to the center, making it larger and larger.
This is a way of representing huge amounts of information.
Yes.
Or in another display, by simply touching little icons in the text, reading more about the topic.
This is how we might do footnotes in the future?
That's right.
The lesson here is that technology could completely change the way we read, like this interactive book.
The computer knows what page I'm on, and I can conduct the book with my hands, creating sounds that are related to the page.
And talk about more of that more later if people have questions. In any event, that these things were sort of interesting because they were provocative objects. They were intended like concept cars in a large automobile manufacturer as things that would speak back to the corporation, back to researchers. They weren't just aimed at that outside world to explain this. You know, here's a reflection of what you might do with your technology. Here's a reflection of what your technology might be. How could that be seen by others? And it raised a lot of interesting research questions. I mean, we realized an epigraphic culture, let's say a wall-reading culture again, since with PowerPoint and various kinds of display technologies, we were starting to read things on the wall, but they weren't stuck on the wall like the way chiseled inscription was. They were ever-changing. You know, those are the kinds of questions that come up as you begin to talk about this from this perspective of this kind of art and engineering dialogue. So how can we apply this? I mean, this is all sort of background. Now what can we do with this? That we can use this as a teaching tool, which I do in the CyberArt class. So it's now called Creative Computing Capstone. And that we can learn at the most basic level the collaboration practices between disciplines. The fact that there are different ones based upon the kinds of disciplines you have together. So how do you learn that? That's the first thing. Second thing is you can compare aesthetics. You can discover that even between, say, electrical engineers and computer scientists, there is a difference, a mismatch in language. And how do you line that up? And one of them is this thing that I identified earlier as aesthetics. There's also, very interestingly, different problem-solving approaches. And we have this new problem-solving class coming up, and I'm coming online now, and I'm really excited by that, because I want to see how a couple of years down, those kinds of problem-solving techniques have reified in the student projects, and how those run up against the ones that people in art and design use. We also begin to learn that methods, design methods, research methods, are often deeply principled, but sometimes we can divorce them, and in fact, in HCI we do this all the time, from those principles. And that gives us a way of actually understanding the process we're engaged in. So it's really interesting to see the art students, for example, say, well, I have this method. Well, can you articulate it? No. And then they show us what they're doing. And she says, well, I know what that is. And that's a pretty interesting way in which we can have a dialogue about process, which is also a dialogue inevitably about the results. So here are just a couple of things from the cyber art class over the last couple of years. Oops, I need to do a little digression again, I've just remembered. That needs no explanation, but that's the thing that's changing everything in HCI, and it's as well changing everything in the cyber art class, because the Wiimote has basically made an awful lot of that soldering, tinkering, and programming for novel interaction easy. In fact, you've got kids in high school who, you know, they look online, they see the videos from the guy at CMU, and they know how to do that immediately. So we're going to see in the next couple of years students coming in with a lot more expertise. In fact, in 1024, I'm told that a good number of the student projects there in engineering ed class are, in fact, Wiimote-based because these kids already know that stuff. It's that easy. So the other piece of this is that this is also stands in for mashups, that we see lots of students who come in art side and the technology side immediately thinking technology mashup. They understand that this thing can go with that thing if they just do something in the middle, and so they're driven to learn just enough to put those two things together. So driven to learn just enough to figure out how they can get the three-axis acceleration data out of that Wiimote and onto their into some application on their laptop using Bluetooth. I mean, they just, you know, they know they have to do something, and they'll figure it out, and they'll find an example online, and then they might do more. They might actually go and try to understand what all that means and what the programming is behind it that actually is driving that. It's really a remarkable device. I mean, I just tossed this in here to say that this is a terrific piece of engineering in here because it really opens up lots of potential. But, you know, the students themselves do all kinds of projects. I won't go through these in detail. But they really drive a lot of interesting ideas in the class. And Wiimotes, again, those were actually Wiimotes there hanging in those wind chimes that people have, I think, seen in the open house at the multimedia room. We also, of course, use the same kind of thinking to drive some research. And this is much more in that blurring the boundaries work that I was talking before. So we see the questions that are raised on the art side influencing the part on the technology side and vice versa, being in the ideas being in dialogue. So a few that are interesting to me is, you know, what does it mean to have technology in a particular place, big displays, and study of meaning. So here's a project that was done by Kunmi Otoju, recently completed her master's program here, called SenseSpace, where she was really interested in what the meaning, the fundamental meaning of interaction is. It's just the beginning of a long body of work, which, alas, I wasn't able to convince her she should stay here and do, on what it is that people get from interacting. Is just a big category, a big abstract idea of interaction, something that itself has meaning, and if so, what are its forms? Another piece of work that's early on, we have Rob Hardy, who's again completing a master's thesis, has been looking at cheats in multiplayer games. Cheats are a really interesting category. I find this really, really interesting, because it turns out that a lot of online games come built with built-in cheats. There are also cheats that you can add, And there are also ways to manipulate the game that the designers hadn't intended. So the question is, what is a cheat? I mean, what is it? We use the word cheat. Is it really a moral and ethical question? Is it really something that is a problem? And in fact, from an HCI standpoint, it's an interesting design problem. How would you make a good cheat? I think this is really fertile ground. And so Bobby Beaton is continuing on that. And he's right now beginning to look at cheating in single-player experiential games like Guitar Hero, Rock Band, and Mario Kart. And I think this is going to be a really interesting area. Because out of this, we'll probably be able to find ways to talk about design of games, but not just games that are fun and playful, but perhaps games for education, or other things that are constructed as games that we encounter in our lives. So this is a very, very interesting and potentially productive area of research. Also doing another project called Placemark with Deborah Tater and Jen Boyle, who's a professor at Hollins University. This also goes by the name of Vivid Embodiment, which is, I think, how the grant was originally acquired. We have some students here, June Sook Lee, Bobby Beaton, Matt Schaefer, and then Allie Crandall, who is a Hollins University student. And this is all about writing in place. Remember I talked about writing in place and boost pedonically? But this is a different kind of writing in place. This is about taking your laptop and writing. And so as you can see here, that they're outdoors. This is an area on a hill up behind Hollins University. In order to get network connectivity, because it's not just about writing alone on your laptop in a place, it's about writing together with other people. So we've had to build a portable network. Works moderately well in a limited area. And that the students have a laptops, and they're asked by Professor Boyle at Hollins to write about the place that they are in. Now, the place that they are in is this interesting woods that has a history to it. Hollins predates the Civil War, and so a lot of the historical aspects of this spot are connected with slavery. They're connected with the uncomfortable history of this place. It turns out that just on the other side of the woods is where most of the service people who work at Hollins have lived, but they've lived there for generations. In fact, they're the descendants of the slaves that came there that were there originally, many of them. So it's a very interesting and very fraught and contentious place. Although when you go out there, it's just a field, just the woods. So the students go out and they write. They can write little notes using Placemark, and they can share these. So when you write, you're not writing privately, you're writing publicly. Furthermore, you also have a GPS device, and that you can tag the writing that you have done with that location. And so it just shows up as a textual tag. You don't have to do it, but you can, so that you have a way of locating. We're also giving them some tools, some very embodied tools, not some fancy tools. These are all quite intentionally not doing things as well as doing things. But one of the things it is doing here is giving them a way of finding where that tag location is relative to where they are now. But notice it says, it's got this compass on there. There's not a compass in your computer. In fact, they have to figure out which way is north, south, east, and west. They have to do that in a way that just as like they were scouts, right? They have to take a compass out, we give them a compass, they have to say, oh, that means over there. How else would they locate this? So that's one of the questions we want to know. What would be a way that you'd want to locate yourself in this space? So we want to keep the people aware of their environment. We don't want this to collapse or model the environment in the computer quite intentionally, because we want the people to be aware of that space they're in. So that's part of the agenda here. Again, this is still work in progress, just like the cheat work is under development. So now let's talk more ambitiously about what art can bring to a collaboration. Now, why is this a good thing? Well, it's a good thing because Richard Florida says it's a good thing. It's a good thing because among the many things that were not cut in the budget that the Center for Creative Technologies and the Arts was not cut. In fact, it was getting, so it's still one of the things that the administration believes in. So why is this important? What's the good reason for doing this? And from abstract standpoint, first of all, art does not need a problem to be solved. You know, people do art for reasons that are not necessarily problem solving. But those that do, that the art problems are always on the table. It's always open to change or interpretation. It's not like I've got a commitment to this and, you know, people depend on it, and so therefore I can't change it. Interesting enough, of course, there's no stopping rule. And I'm going to give a great example of that in a minute. And therefore, there's no stopping rule for the project or to the boundaries of what a project might be. And also, there's an emphasis on seeing as opposed to just the doing. So it's the artist is a person who can see the thing that the others haven't seen. And so that leads us to a kind of entrepreneurial energy. I mean, that's one of the reasons why this is deeply connected to innovation. And that's the reason we're on this long path down here. It's not just that these are fun and that, you know, people feel good when they do them. It's in the fact that it gives a kind of permission in a technology exploration that you otherwise wouldn't have. And therefore, for the student or for a faculty member that is actually kind of driven, it sort of opens up opportunities. And so here's three examples of student projects where we've seen that entrepreneurial zeal. This is a project called EW, which a mashup. They found online this sliced up human body that you could look at by, you know, they'd actually taken a cadaver and sliced it froze it and sliced it up, and they took pictures of it and put them online. But the only way to navigate this thing was through a very clunky and very indirect interface. So they took a flock of birds, position sensor, and then they just had these little either cardboard cutout or plastic model of human body. And so for middle school kids, they could position this thing over this three-dimensional physical model and get the slice through the body and see where it was, so they could actually stand up and look around at the body and then come back and look what the slice would be. The slice, by the way, doesn't have to be horizontal, even though it shows it in this game. That's EW. Another one is QuakeView. Now, this is really the interesting cross product of two different worlds. This takes a DJ's scratcher interface, which the student built, and plugs it into a huge database of earthquake information, seismic data. And the hard-to-see lever on the left changes the time scale, which you can see on the left side of the display. And then the CD is a spin, so you can go backwards and forwards in time. Yep, very good, Stacy. Not Stacy's surprise, but she's physically able to simulate. And what's particularly interesting is that seismic data has patterns in it. And to be able to see the patterns at different scales next to one another, or to move between the scales quickly, was very difficult for seismologists. And they were stunned when they were able to see it this way. It never occurred to them that by quickly moving in the space of a few minutes through their data that way, that they could see these patterns, that they would spend hours and hours and hours sort of laboriously making, you know, printing something out and comparing them. And in fact, this really radically changed their practice. The last piece is an art student, not an engineering student, an OCS student, Charles Wood, very driven kid, started in our cyber art class, the project called Body Labs. In the end, this ended up at the SIGGRAPH Art Show, so we'll get there from here. But Charles built, among other things, a full motion capture environment that he installed. There's a little defunct school up in, I think it's Newport, that rents out space to artists. And so over the course of 6 months, he would go up there every day using this equipment and would photograph himself. And the idea was that he was working out and on a diet and that his body shape would change, but that he would do things like swing a baseball bat or be on this exercise bike and change his body position just slightly so that when you played all these still images back in sequence that he recorded over the course of 6 months, it would look like an animation of him swinging the baseball bat or pedaling the bicycle or doing push-ups. And in fact, this is a very complex interactive database. The motion capture was of him swinging the baseball bat, but he would stand there in this position, and it would take picture, so that you could see him effectively in three dimensions from any position in space, because it had used that very complex morphing algorithm that you see in movies today. to do that. But this was not, this has, as I said, art has no stopping rule. Charles became very driven, so he talked somebody into building an app for the iPhone that would track, so he could track his food intake and his exercise and just about anything else that he thought was affecting his physique over this, which then came into this very complex database, which is, for him, both a work of art and a kind of tool for carrying out the work of art. So it's a little bit like the artist showing off the brushes he used to paint the painting, but we also think of this as a kind of interesting byproduct of this system. So that's in addition to all this work that he did in animation and multimedia. And then finally, the thing was shown at SIGGRAPH in, alas, it didn't look quite as spiffy as this, as I understand it, that SIGGRAPH came with a much smaller booth and a much smaller projector, but that was the general idea. But that was Charles and Body Labs, and that was all driven, as I said, out of this no-stopping rule aspect of art. So we've talked a little bit about here about the nature of research and nature of innovation and art, science, design, and engineering, and we've looked at some modes of cross-disciplinary collaboration, and we've been blurring the boundaries. You know, on this slide, call them post-20th century collaborations. That is, that these boundaries really do look like a new way of thinking about the disciplinary boundaries falling, a new way of thinking about what our role is as researchers in a particular kind of discipline. Well, that, I'm done. Thank you. Questions?
I feel special. A lot of the design processes that we use in software engineering and now trickling into HCI are iterative, incremental, and I'm wondering if you can comment on how that interacts with innovation.
Well, it's in two ways. I mean, there's the, at the kind of just straight up technology version of this, forgetting the collaborative aspects of it, that one of the most prolific inventors at Park said the best way for him to invent something new is to read other people's patents. And that, you know, seeing what the other person hasn't seen is in the nature of the iteration. You know, if you're just throwing away or fixing the things that are broken, that's a pretty limited vision of iteration. You know, as long as you can see that the new thing you're doing is part of a path of convergence, you know, that's fine, an iterative process, but it's not enough in the end. You know, you have to go through that kind of refinement process in order to actually sell something and put it on the street, but we usually call that development, we don't call that research. Yep. Hey, it went to the top.